Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Merry Christmas, Savage Nation. And here is a gift for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best of the best from the month of July. So why were we in Iraq? Nobody knows. It was Bush's blunder. In plain English, he was whispered in his ear by a Weekly Standard crowd, of whom Bill Kristol is the general. He's the general. He's the armchair general. Yeah, go in because they bombed us. Now go into Afghanistan because they didn't bomb us, but they're generally no good, and we're gonna build a nation of Democrats. Democratic, they're going to go and vote now with a dot on their head. They're going to go in and vote, and they're all going to be happy when you put up a camel burger stand. They're going to put on a little hat and say, would you like camel dung with that burger? Fried, whatever they eat there. I don't know, camel burger. I don't think they kill their camels over there. They all can't wait to work in a camel stand selling camel meat. They can't wait to become a real American. They just can't wait to see Walmart on every corner in Kabul and the McDonald's and a pizza place. And then they cannot wait. They just can't wait to see internet pornography in every home. They can't wait to see their daughters become whores like the American women. They can't wait to see them wearing tight pants, showing everything you never wanted to see. They just can't wait to see the women walking around like Jezebels. Everything they've ever wanted, they can't wait to come into their country. Let me tell you something. If you were in Afghanistan, you'd be fighting along with them to make sure that the poison doesn't come into their household. And moreover, they would rather not see our legal system come into their country. They'd rather trust their life with a warlord than with a Harvard lawyer. They feel they get more justice from a warlord than they would from Marvin Schwartz from Harvard. And if you don't like what I'm saying, it's too bad. Go sue me. See if you can ban me in America next. I don't care. I'm too old to give a damn. I've earned the right to tell you the way I see it. And I'm going to tell you the way I see it. And you ought to be glad that I'm on the radio. You ought to be glad that you have Michael Savage speaking the truth. Because without me, what would there be? What you'd have is the neocons saying, go to war. War is good. Let your children die. Because we don't have any, because we never even got married. And we did get married. We married sterile girls in their 30s who don't even want children. They only married us for our broadcast money. Yeah, tell it like it is, man. Yeah, you tell them, Mike. Go, man, go. If you care to comment on any or all of these topics, I guess you could call the show. And while you do, I think I'm going to tell you about a pizza story, my pizza story. I had a no barbecue this year. I've given up entertaining my friends because they never reciprocate. And if they do reciprocate, they're usually terrible cheap barbecues, so I don't go anyway. When I do a barbecue, I spend a lot of money and have really high-end food. If they invite you back, it's usually a few Hebrew Nationals and a cheap, a beer from Mexico that was out of date that they found in the back of the refrigerator. So I stopped going. So I was just into one of my moods of leave me alone. I can't wait till the holiday is over. It's cold out here, by the way. And I live in San Francisco because it is the most beautiful place on earth in the summer. It was 49 this morning. The fog comes in blowing over the hills out of the ocean. And you're like, I need an overcoat and a scarf and a wool hat today, which I love. I adore it. My face is cool. I need gloves. People don't understand it. I mean, if you're a heat lover, God bless you. I'm not. You know, I could do without waiting for global warming. So the fact is, I figured enough is enough. I ordered a pizza. I just wanted a pizza. I've been on a no-dairy diet for about a year and 6 months now because I had some very severe aches in my, I'm going to tell you point blank, in my arches and my hands. And I remember writing my own books, and I said, Doctor, heal thyself. Read your own books. And I said, my God, that's right. Don't eat dairy if you're allergic to it, if you are deficient in lactase, as I apparently am. cut the dairy out. Well, I cut it out, and after a few weeks, all these severe aches went away. I'm telling you, it was so bad. I was seeing foot doctors and this and that. So I haven't had pizza in a year and a half, which I'm crazy about pizza. I crave it. But a great doctor friend of mine taught me 20 years ago that we usually are addicted to that which we are allergic to. We are addicted to that which we are allergic to. Did you know that? The things you crave are the things that make you sick, whether it be in foods or drink or sex. Think about what I just said to you. So anyway, I broke the addiction to dairy. I mean, 100% none, zero, and all the pains went away. So I order a pizza. Now, here's the first mistake. I ordered a pizza. Here's the second mistake. I ordered a pizza from someone who's not Italian, who just bought a local pizza franchise, who can hardly speak English. Here's my third mistake. I believed it would be there when he said it would be there. Here's my fourth mistake. I blew up on the phone when it wasn't there on time. Pennsylvania, Gene, you're on the Savage Nation topic, please.
Mike, I'd like to hear what happened to the pizza.
Right. Now, that's probably as important as what happened to NASA, is what happened to my pizza, right?
Yeah,
so when we left off on that side story, I was not going to do a barbecue because I'm sick and tired of entertaining friends who don't reciprocate. So I said, you know what, I'm just going to stay home and have a pizza, right? Is that what? And then, so I call a pizza place, and I haven't had one in a year and a half. And the guy answers, I must tell you, he was not Italian. That's okay. I could hardly make out his accent, but it sounded like some kind of lower Shanghainese accent to the best of my ability to understand it, which unto itself is not a problem in that I don't really care who owns a pizzeria if they could still make pizza. For example, the Brazilians make the best pizza in America, incidentally. Brazilian pizza is by and large the best. Well, many of them are of Italian heritage, but that's irrelevant. So I said, okay, how long will the pizza take? Now, I want to tell you what a large pizza costs in my community. 30 smackers. I said, $30 for a large pizza? Are you kidding me? No, he says, that's the price. I figured, all right, I'm not going to quibble. I just didn't have the strength for it. All right, send it. I said, but be sure you send the condiments. Why comment? What do you mean comment? I said condiments. I didn't say comments. I didn't say send me the comments. I said send me the condiments. What? Come on. I said I want the Parmesan cheese. I want the red pepper. You know, all of those little packets of garbage that cost them nothing. Okay. How long will it take? He says 45 minutes. Thank you. Goodbye. Now, it's 6:30. So I figured, all right, I'm hungry. By 7:15, the pie will be there. I call a friend in the city. Now, remember, I'm not in San Francisco at this time. My house is about 30 minutes out of the city. Call a friend. I said, you want to come over? Okay, I'll come over. My friend arrives from San Francisco, and the pizza is still not there. Now it's an hour. I call up the friendly pizza man, and I say, I called you an hour ago. Where's the pizza? And he argues with me. He says, no, it was 59 minutes ago. I said, but you said 45 minutes. We're running late. And he says, don't get so excited. Here's the part that burned me. He said, don't get so excited. It's only a pizza. He had the nerve to say that to me. It's only a pizza. You hear the guy buys a franchise and he's telling me it's only pizza. So I'm boiling already. But I figured, look, they could spit in it or worse. I didn't say anything. I bit my tongue. I said, make sure the man has the condiments. Another 15 minutes already. My neck is swollen from anger. Ring, ring goes the bell. I open the gate. A guy arrives with the pizza, and I said, open it up, I want to make sure it's hot. He looks at me like with a lower, like his lower jaw is hanging, like Slattern, like he just came off a pyramid somewhere in South America. He was just busy working on a pyramid, and he said, I said, where are the condiments? He says, I don't know what you're, like in broken English, what are you talking about? You didn't ask for them. I said, get it out of here, I don't want it. Take it, goodbye, take it, I don't care, goodbye, get out of here, get off my property. I threw him off the property. I call up the owner. I said, do you know that your driver showed up without the cheese? And so he says to me, well, you mean he didn't have it in his car? I said, you're asking me what he had in his car? And we had an argument, and I said, you know what? You're never going to make it in this town if you have that attitude. You don't belong in the food business. And I hung up. So then I'm starving. Meanwhile, I invite a friend out from the city, and there's nothing on the table except homegrown garlic, which I had chopped up and put in oil. And I had just picked some oregano from my garden, from a little garden I keep, and put the oregano out. I mean, I really like to eat right, okay? Meanwhile, there's no pizza. So I said, let's jump in the car. Jump in the car, we go to the corner, there's a Brazilian pizza guy. I call it, and by the time I get there, it's ready. I eat it, I get it, we're back, boom. We were so hungry, we ordered two slices while we were waiting for the pie to be hot. But that's the pizza story. It just shows you today that nothing is right. Nothing is right in this country anymore. It's the attitude. The work ethic is gone. There's no desire to please the customer, and there's no desire in the government to please the taxpayer. Everybody has a middle finger in the air.
Savage.
Hano, hano, wale o hanale. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. O kamana ake akua. I ole kamana o na lapu. You forgot I lived in Hawaii many years. Hey, mele maka ala kawaii. Maka I no kawaii. I loved Hawaii. I lived there many, many years. It's an interesting language, all syllables. But you don't know about that. They're going to be independent very soon. I don't know how they're going to make a living. They're going to kick the white man out. Then what are they going to have? Beautiful culture up to a point. But there's a whole language. You don't realize people have a language because you don't speak it. It's a big world out there. How many languages are there? How many languages are there? My God. I wonder if Obama speaks any Hawaiian. That would be kind of an interesting question. In that he grew up there. But most people who are not Hawaiian don't speak any of the language. It's not an easy language for a Westerner in that it's not a romance language, for one. And to get into the syllables, it's very difficult to comprehend a language that's based upon syllables, you know. Hano hana wale o hanale. So glorious is hanale. If you know what hanale is, how beautiful it is. How about if I said to you, is God more powerful or the power of ghosts? Oikimana ake akua. Aole kamana a nalapu. Pardon me for mangling the syllables. Okay, I've had my fun. Waola au! Now I'm starting to sound like the hemorrhoid with eyes. That means I am saved in a church. I am saved. Waola au! Oh, God, he shouldn't be listening to this show. Ola ka mo'i ke akua. God save the king. Anyway, you get the picture. I watched the movie. The movie was All Quiet on the Western Front, a remake from 1979, starring Ernest Borgnine, of all people, which was unbelievable. I had seen the original All Quiet on the Western Front, the black and white one. I read the book by Ray Marquet. But I will tell you, this movie was so disquieting, All Quiet on the Western Front. It takes a group of upper-class German boys and follows them through their school years, enlisting in the army, actually being drafted in the army, all the way through the basic training into the army, being butchered on the Western Front, gassed, bayoneted. It was unbelievable to me to watch this because they became real to you. And all I could think of was the hell of war and how any man who has ever gone to war is anti-war. I don't believe there's one man listening to the show who was in the military who wants to go to war again to kill somebody unless he's a psychopath. The only people who seem to want to go to war are people like the Weekly Standard crowd in New York, the guys who never were in the military themselves, who egged Bush on to invade Iraq, who egged Bush on to invade Afghanistan, who are now cheering Obama for continuing the neocon policy of endless war. You see, guys at the Weekly, the guy whose father gave him, Bill Kristol, his father set him up in business. Bill Kristol looks like a decent enough kind of guy, but never was in the military. If he's so gung-ho for the war, why doesn't Bill Kristol just get on a little weight loss program, run around the Central Park Reservoir for a month, and enlist in the military, go over there, and go on the front lines in Afghanistan. Go ride in a Humvee. Go ride in a Humvee, Bill. Then we'll believe a word you say. There's only one reason this country has been at war for the last 15 years or so. It seems like forever we've been at war. And that is the government military-industrial complex. The military-industrial complex that the great general and President Dwight D. Eisenhower warned us about. Eisenhower was the supreme Allied commander in World War II. He led the led the invasion of Normandy, the beaches of Normandy, for example. He was the number one guy. He went all the way back to World War I. He became the president in the 1950s. And the man was anti-war. The man said, beware the military-industrial complex. In fact, if you have that sound, we're going to play it in the next segment on the show, because that's what we're living through right now. I know young men who have fought in Iraq and are fighting in Afghanistan. I've asked them, why are we there? They said, we don't know. They have no idea what their mission is. Nobody knows what the hell we're doing in Afghanistan. All they know is that they've been sent there and they have to come back in one piece. And all they know is that they're sent there for reasons somebody else knows, but they don't know. There is no mission. There is no purpose to the mission. And the only people who are for the war, certainly not the left wing, doesn't want us to be in Afghanistan, even though they egged it on for years. Remember all the years that Bush was in Iraq? The vermin on the left was saying, oh, it's the wrong war. You should have invaded Afghanistan. They used to call the show. Why should you invade Afghanistan? Did the Afghanis attack us on 9/11? Afghanistan is a country that is run by troglodytes, medieval cavemen, troglodytes who circumcise their women with blunt instruments. They live in caves. They kill each other. They have been killing each other. They beat the British three times. There's no end in sight to the war. It has bankrupted our treasury. But more importantly, it has committed mayhem against our young men. And so I say, well, what does Oakland have to do with Afghanistan? The same thing that Oscar Grant Sr. said is what I'm trying to tell you. The Bible may say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but we're not living in biblical times. We have to be better than the troglodytes. That does not mean we have no right to defend ourselves. That does not mean if after we leave Afghanistan and more troglodytes come there from Dearborn or Newark or San Francisco or Paris and they all flood in there because, hey, we now have a homeland. Yee-hee. The troglodytes now have a homeland and it's called Afghanistan. I say then unleash what we have on them. Mark Masters, who has syndicated me for over 9 years now, and we're going to be, as Harry Truman said, give him you-know-what for the next couple of years. That's our job. Our job is to be watchdogs, not to be lapdogs, Mark. And I want to thank you for giving me total and absolute freedom to do so. That's the point I'm trying to make. I wouldn't have lasted a week with another syndicator. I could never have sat down after a show and been deconstructed where they say, well, you said this, tomorrow don't say that.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best of the best from the month of July. Red diaper dopa babies are ruling this country. What they don't know is that marijuana, although it may be so-called natural, marijuana is far more dangerous than tobacco smoke. Do you know that marijuana, mainstream marijuana, has ammonia levels that are up to 20-fold greater than that found in tobacco? Hydrogen cyanide, nitrogen oxide, and some aromatic amines, which are all carcinogenic, were found in marijuana smoke at concentrations 3 to 5 times those found in tobacco smoke. But you can't tell that to potheads. Potheads are brainwashed. They don't know that they have mercury, for example, in much of the marijuana that is grown today is grown on volcanic soil. I talked about this for years. And you know the story of the Mad Hatter. I told you about the Mad Hatter. The Mad Hatter was a fable. But what does the Mad Hatter actually mean? In the old days, hats had hat bands that were stiff, and they were meant to make the hat stiff, right? And how did they make the hat band stiff? They dipped the hat band, the fabric, into a liquid mercury, because mercury, when it hardens, is hard, like a metal. It's a heavy metal. And then they put the hat band around the hat. Unfortunately, the people who were hatters, H-A-T-T-E-Rs, as opposed to the haters we've been playing, the hatters very often became insane from having exposed themselves to mercury, methyl mercury, because they dipped their hands in the solution. They didn't use gloves. They didn't know any different then. And the mercury migrated through their skin into their serum, and they wound up with methyl mercury poisoning, one of the symptoms being acting like the mayor of San Francisco, or let's say the former governor of California, or any one of the current federal officials who are appointed by Obama. They would be classic examples of they would be showing classic symptoms of methylmercury poisoning, that they hate a nation that has given them so much. But there are other examples of the Mad Hatter out there. But anyway, the long and short of it is many people who smoke marijuana don't realize that they're uptaking an awful lot of mercury in the marijuana smoke. That's what I was trying to say to you. So they're mad. They're crazy, half crazy from the THC and half crazy from the mercury that they've been getting from the marijuana grown in volcanic soil, because volcanic soil happens to be very rich in mercury. And so when the plant grows in that soil, it takes up the metals in the soil. And it winds up in the marijuana schmuck. And when you smoke it, putz, it winds up in your brain, which is why you can't get a job and you're still living at home and you still hate America, you moron. Throw away the marijuana cigarette. You might have a chance at life, you schmuck. Or you're liable to wind up another loser at 50 walking the street hating the world, is what I like to say to you. Unfortunately, I don't know you, but I know you just heard me. Mr. Mercury, cadmium, lead, chromium, nickel, arsenic, selenium, pyridine, quinoline, isoprene, acrylonitrile, benzene, toluene, styrene, formaldehyde, acetaldehyde, acetone, acrolein, propionaldehyde, crotonaldehyde, methyl ketone, butyraldehyde, hydroquinone, resorcinol, catechol, phenol, cresol, naphthalene, all aboard, fluorine, panthethine, anthracene, fluoranthetine, pyrene, benzoanthracene, chrysine, benzoafluoranthine, benzoclaforanthine, benzoepyrene, benzoapyrene, pyrolene, my friends. All in that natural marijuana smoke that you think is natural, boys and girls, because your teachers told you it was better and safer than alcohol and better and safer than big tobacco. But in fact, my friends, that's why you're a loser. My friends, that's why you can't get a job. My friends, that's why you're lazy, and that's why you're unmotivated. That's why you hate your mother. That's why you hate your father, and that's why you hate your country. It's all because of the Mad Hatter within.
Volare, oh, e andare, oh, nel blu, dipinto di blu. Che dici di stare lassù? E volavo, volavo, venice con alto.
I don't know what year it was, 85. I was a corporate consultant. I was flying around the country. And in those days, you could drink on the plane. You know, there was no like a security like today, the insanity of today. For better or for worse, that's the world we're living in. So we hit turbulence, as I say, somewhere, I don't know, Midwest, I don't know where. Like, we had a turbulent situation last week. People got injured on a plane because the pilot flew through it, whatever. So here we're bouncing around, and I'm ordering drinks. And the stewardess in those days was serving the drinks. She's holding on to chairs, and the way they calmed you down is that if there was a guy who liked to drink during turbulence, they served you. So I'm sitting there, and next to me is a very elegant Chinese lady who it turned out was the CEO of a major American corporation. And she wouldn't say a word to me when she got on. I wasn't pestering her. You get on. I was, you know, first class, big deal. What that means today, nothing. And I wanted to be, you know, a conversation. How are you? And nothing. All right. So I leave her alone. I figured that's what she wants. She has a right. You know what I mean? So I go about my business, and I'm writing my stuff and reading. She don't talk. I don't talk. About 2 hours later, the turbulence, and I'm drinking. By this time already, I was flying high. I was drinking my way across America, as I normally did in those days. I ordered more. I guess I said, give me two at this time. And I'm having a good time. And I'm writing when pasta was spaghetti, having a great time flying over the Rockies. And the woman was so frightened, she reached out and grabbed my arm, and she said something to me, who remembers what? And I started speaking with her. It turns out that her father or grandfather in China, so she told me, was a famous healer and herbalist. So we had a lot to talk about. I never saw her again. But the point is that I wrote a wonderful poem in the turbulence of those times, in those turbulent times, entitled When Pasta Was Spaghetti. Let's hear it right now. The hairy forearms of New York serve you your coffee with a turning gesture, an offering that says drink, eat, enjoy. The wiry Italian in Vincent's clam bar, the one behind the greased over register, the young kid connected who receives his deference from the spaghetti cook older than his gangster father, the spaghetti cook who looks like an old-fashioned doctor from the Bronx with clipped mustache. He actually pulls some noodles out of the pot and eats them as they cook, looking to the grimy ceiling for his tender answer. Well, they used to call it spaghetti. Now it's pasta at $10 a plate. The smoky windows of Romeo's Spaghetti now offers radios and knickknacks. It was 50 cents a plate then. In neon letters that you couldn't miss, even through a fogged over window on a cold winter's eve, there was life. Marinara sauce that smacked to the sea. Noodles as long as your young arm. Meatballs as fluffy as your dream of them. Bread on the table you'd eat against your parents' admonitions that the meal was coming, the meal was coming. And men, some burly with black hairy forearms whose smile scared you, and little skinny guys with the look of murder on their faces, and people who slurped their spaghetti straight to their mouths from the plate, one motion like Chinese shoveling rice at mouth with clicking sticks. That was gusto before it became a beer ad. That was taste before it became a synonym for fashion. That was spaghetti before it became pasta. Now you're supposed to play the tarantella, will you please? That's what keeps the audience going. That's right. God, I'd love to go to an Italian wedding in the backyard today. I wish I had that to look forward to Saturday. No one has that. Everything's too fancy. That's the problem. I remember hearing when I was young the story of the Italian who grew up very poor, and he worked hard, became a very wealthy man. And as he was going along, you know, he went from what he had in his house, because the parents were humble, you know, the homemade wine, the homemade sausage, and the father smoked these 10-cent cigars, whatever they were called, the Roytans, I don't even know what they were, from the candy store. But as the son became a rich man in America, particularly in California, he got to the Cuban cigar and the $200, $300, $400 bottle of wine and everything the best, the Ferrari, the Rolls. And then as the man, the rich man, became older and he could settle down and no longer had to make waves and show who he was, and he just settled into living his life on his estate, his clothing became simpler again. He'd often be seen walking around his estate in old clothes and shamble around in his undershirt. And guess what? He came to love the homemade wine again and the cigars that his servant got for him down in the luncheonette in the poorer districts. And you know something? I got to tell you, there's a lot of truth to that story. The reason it's true is because what in the world do you really need when it comes right down to it? You need your health, number one. I don't want to get into this whole old, you know, but what do you really need? You need your health and you need your family. So if you have your health and your family, I mean, the rest is gravy. Isn't that true? I mean, what do you really want? What do you really want? I don't know. What am I asking you this question for? You can't answer me anyway. I love Danny and the Juniors. I don't know about you. It's when America was great, when the chrome was thick and the women were women. When the chrome was thick and the women were women. There's no chrome in the cars anymore. When the record starts spinning, you chill it, so when you're chicken at the hop, do the dance and say something. I got a 65 caddy with a pair of bumpers on her. This is the one after the Dagmar caddy. It's you know, the 59 was the Dagmar years. But then the chrome, you know where the chrome came from? You're talking about minerals. The chrome came out of New Caledonia, a lot of it. An island in the South Pacific. The French had the exclusive mining rights to the chrome. I think after they mined it to extinction, we went to the Toyota concept of a car, which is virtually no bumpers or rubber bumper. I don't like bumpers that aren't chrome, by the way, because every nick you have to go to a body shop. When did they come up with that? You talk about built-in obsolescence.
All the stories have been told of kings in days of old, but there's no England now. All the wars that were won or lost somehow don't seem to matter very much anymore.
I wonder if the standards and values of England include polluting the Gulf of Mexico. I wonder if the standards and values of England include using shoddy equipment and faulty inspections when drilling in the backyard of the United States of America. I wonder if the standards and values of Britain include permitting real terrorists, the children of real terrorists and murderers, to visit England and to spew real hatred and to talk about real murder. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Savage Nation. At the risk of your displeasure, I feel I must talk a little bit more about the fact that Britain, under the so-called conservative government, has continued the exact same policies of the Socialist Labour Party that preceded them, which is amazing to me. It should be amazing to you. You know, I have a black colleague, and I was speaking with him about my being banned in the UK this morning. And I said to him, even the so-called conservative regime in England is refusing to undo the damage done to my name and reputation, let alone my personal safety. So my black friend said to me, you know, Savage, you're being treated by the British the way blacks were treated by southern white bigots in the 1940s and 50s in the South. I was stunned, frankly, by his observation. I said, you know, there is a great deal of truth in what you said. You see, in the South before the 60s, black people in the South were routinely convicted of crimes without a fair trial. I want you to think about what I'm saying. I, Michael Savage, have been tried and convicted of a crime by the British government without the benefit of any trial nor the right to defend myself. In the Jim Crow era, racists in the South made sure that blacks had separate and inferior accommodations on trains, buses, and in hotels, while in the England of today, I have been denied any accommodation whatsoever. In the South of the pre-civil rights era, even drinking fountains had signs on them that said whites only. Well, today there's a sign in England that says leftists only. Michael Savage need not apply. I believe England selected Michael Savage for discrimination because I'm not a Muslim. I believe they attack me because I'm a conservative. I believe they attack me because I stand for national sovereignty and national identity in a world where they want that to dissolve. And they attacked me because they want to appease their own guilty consciences with regard to their inherent racism and anti-nationalism. England's liberalism allows the virus of radical Islam to spread unabated, while conservatism would contain this virus, which threatens to destroy the entire world, and conservatism is banned. Despite a new prime minister, Britain's travel ban for Michael Savage continues. Britain bans Michael Savage again and welcomes Che Guevara's daughter. The Savage Nation versus the Dying Nation. These are some of the wonderful blog items that have been written. Probably one of the best, or my favorite thus far, is the one written by Humberto Fontova. Now, Humberto Fontova is of Cuban ancestry. He knows what Fidel Castro and Che Guevara really are. What sickens me and turns my stomach is the way the vermin in the American media are glorifying that mass murderer, Fidel Castro, every time he burps. They make believe he's the father of the world. The man is a murderer, a mass murderer. And yet the idiots in the media glorify him. They hold him up as a role model, a man who's killed so many. Do you know that in Castro's Cuba, I don't think you know this. Do you know any of what I'm about to tell you? Do you know that in Castro's Cuba, more people were killed proportionate to the population than in the early years of the Hitler regime? Do you know that in Castro's Cuba, more people were killed than in the Stalinist regime and in the early days of the Stalinist regime? And yet, they still have pictures of Che Guevara on the walls of universities. Now, it gets even worse. What gets me is that Che Guevara's daughter was invited to the United Kingdom after I was banned from the United Kingdom. And here's what he writes. He said, instead of the false contrition, groveling, and confessions that Stalin, Mao, and Che Guevara demanded from the subjects they accused of thought crimes before murdering them, Michael Savage sought to repudiate his listing alongside terrorists and Nazis by resorting to the tenets of Western jurisprudence and presenting evidence to the contrary. He writes, in today's Britain, what's left of the Magna Carta only works in favor of actual Islamic terrorists. 1 month after insulting and banning Michael Savage last summer, Britain opened their arms to Che Guevara's daughter, Alida. The occasion was a celebration in London titled Cuba 50, billed as the biggest European celebration in the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution. Really? And then he writes, Britain threw the continent's biggest party commemorating 50 years of Castro's Stalinist regime, which jailed political prisoners at a higher rate than Stalin's, murdered political prisoners at a higher rate than pre-war Hitler's, and came closest of anyone to plunging the world into nuclear war. Che's daughter was there to promote, in her own words, my father's ideals, his concerns, and his ambitions. She said, I believe that my father is a banner to the world. If we could only follow his example, the world would be a much more beautiful place. So, Umberto writes, fine, let's have a look at Alida's father's ambitions, keeping in mind that what got Michael Savage banned was his purported fostering of extremist views and his so-called hate speech. I will quote now Ernesto Che Guevara. Hatred, he said, is the central element of our struggle. Hatred that is intransigent. Hatred so violent that it propels a human being beyond his natural limitations, making him violent and cold-blooded killing machine. We reject any peaceful approach. Violence is inevitable. To establish socialism, rivers of blood must flow. The imperialist enemy must feel like a hunted animal wherever he moves. Thus we'll destroy him. These hyenas, the Americans, are fit only for extermination. We must keep our hatred alive and fan it to paroxysm. The victory of socialism is well worth millions of atomic victims. Che Guevara, in a speech in 1966 to the Tricontinental Conference in Havana. He writes, no rational person would require much elasticity of definition to classify Alita's father, Che Guevara, this banner to the world, as hate speech. And Alida Guevara, in an interview with The Guardian during the visit to England, boasted of her fervent fostering of a father's view. Listen to this. Here's what she said in England. I want you to ask yourself, do you think Che Guevara's daughter could provoke intra-community violence? Listen to what she said. I want to be like Che and fight until final victory. Then you feel elated. It is preferable to sink in the sea than to betray the glory that once lived. Ladies and gentlemen, this is it. Gun butts and bayonets bashing in the brains of the people of the United States of America are not what you are experiencing. You're not experiencing socialism's gun butts and bayonets yet. What you're experiencing is the brain beating of an incessant propaganda machine both in Britain and the United States. Now, what do I mean by that? It's very simple what I mean by that. It means that they let mass murderers' daughters in to talk about mass murder and socialism, and they ban a conservative who believes in nationalism. I'll let you figure out the battle that is ongoing and what side you have to be on.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. We are opening with a theme from Love Story, because this is the music that apparently Al Gore wrote. In fact, he wrote the book and he appeared in the movie. But I'm sorry, this song will never be the same for me after what came out. It has now turned into the soundtrack for a sort of softcore porno film, Love Story, because two other women have claimed that Al Gore abused them, and they're both old masseuses. This one says it happened in the Beverly Hills Hotel when Gore was in Hollywood to attend the Oscars in 07. So when I hear Love Story now, I mean, this comes to mind. A therapist claimed that when they were alone, Gore shrugged off a towel and stood naked in front of her. He pointed at a certain part of his body and said, take care of this. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is because Al Gore deserves it. Even if it's not true, he deserves it. And the reason is because he's faked the world out for so long with the man-caused global warming scam. He's made a fortune off it. A fortune. And the irony of the Al Gore story, which I'll never understand how the people in the media are so naive and gullible, they don't understand it. Al Gore's father, Senator Al Gore, after he retired from the Senate, went to work for Arm & Hammer, Occidental Petroleum. Nothing wrong with that. Straight up. Occidental Coal Company. His father became the president of Occidental Coal. Al Gore inherited his money from the Occidental years. Al Gore has been deeply enmeshed in the oil industry from the time he was an infant. And now for him to make a fortune by attacking the oil industry and peddling the so-called green industry and peddling books that are lies is amazing to me. There is a certain truth in the statement that God sees the truth but waits. That's all I can say to you. By the way, there is a... I don't believe personally that Mark Twain really said that France has neither winters nor summers or morals. And I also think it's a lie that General Patton used to say, quote, "I'd rather have a German division in front of me than a French division behind me." However, there is still a rumor going around that an American general once said that going to war without France is the same as going deer hunting without your accordion. I can't confirm that. I like that one. Going to war without France is the same as going deer hunting without your accordion. I have some relatives who just came back from Europe. They loved Italy. They were stunned by the austerity of Switzerland, how cold it was. They were kind of stupefied by the German coldness, but loved the cleanliness and the outfits. And, of course, they ran into the hatred of the French. But I said, don't take it personally. I sent them an email while they were in Europe. I said, the French have been that way since Napoleon. They have a grandiose sense of themselves. But, frankly, unfortunately, the French have produced nothing since Napoleon. And, well, he was the Hitler of his time anyway. I mean, Napoleon was the Hitler of that period. And they're living on this image of the imperial presidency of Napoleon. You hear this? Look who they still glorify, the Napoleonic era. Do you know how many Frenchmen died because of that lunatic? When he invaded Russia in the winter, you know how many came back from that invasion? And it shows you how history repeats itself, that Hitler invades Russia and gets caught there in the winter, in the Russian winter. And how many Germans came back from that? I believe 600,000 Germans were captured at Stalingrad after the winter froze them in. And of the 600,000, 10,000 came home after the war. So it just shows you that history does repeat itself. And, of course, we in this country see history repeating itself again in many, many different ways. If you think that the things going on in America today under Obama are brand new, you're wrong. It's history repeating itself. In some ways it is, in some ways it's new, in some ways it's not. We had racists in America in past centuries. We now have, in my opinion, a benign, mild racist administration in power. At this time, they're benign and mildly racist. I believe under the surface, though, there's something much more virulent. And like other diseases, it must be kept under control or it will spread like a wildfire. We have had other presidents who tried to be dictators, who were slapped down by common citizens who took them to court. And I have cited the cases for you. I'll give you again an example. FDR, one of Obama's mentors, so to speak. Would it be only that FDR was one of his mentors? I would sleep better at night, but I think FDR is only a mild example of one of Obama's mentors. But FDR had grandiose ideas of the power of the presidency, and FDR glorified many of the socialist inventions of Stalin, and he tried to introduce them to America, with the exception of, let's say, the death camps and the gulag. But FDR overreached his power, and I'll tell you again, the Schechter brothers. It's actually in my new book coming out. I can't wait for it to come out. Every time I tell a good story, I can say, you know, go buy the book, but the book's not out yet. I can't even tell you the title. The Schechter brothers were four little kosher butchers. They were brothers in Brooklyn, New York. One of the federal laws passed by FDR said you can only sell kosher chickens in a certain number. You can't sell smaller lots. They said, well, if we do that, we're going to go out of business. We have to sell these kosher chickens to individuals as well to survive. The government put them in jail because they were violating what FDR wanted, which was he was price fixing, in other words. The government was fixing prices on chickens. They couldn't comply. They would have gone out of business. They went to jail. I don't know how long. They came out, and they sued FDR. They sued Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Democrat socialist president. Okay? And guess what? Not only did they win at the Supreme Court level, with a real Supreme Court justice giving a great statement, a real great Supreme Court justice, who, by the way, I think was Jewish and did not eat in Chinese restaurants on Christmas, unlike Elena Kagan, okay? And the justice said that he's going to stop the desire on the part of Franklin Delano Roosevelt to aggrandize even more power in his hands in essence. I'm sure, you know, giving you my own words. And the Schechter brothers were found to be correct. The president was found to be wrong. And listen to this. One of the major, gigantic agencies that had been established by Franklin Delano Roosevelt was dismantled. I pray that come October, just before the election, when this country is going to be in a fever pitch of concern, and they're finally going to understand what we have in the White House and what he's decimated, what he's done to decimate this nation, takes a $1 trillion debt and raises it to $4 trillion. Do you understand what this man has done to us? Put aside all of the social issues. Let's put them aside. They're very important. Let's put aside what he's done to the military, what he's done to NASA, what he's done to our nuclear arsenal, or would do if he's not reined in. Put that aside. Let's make it just dollars and cents. If you look at the story of the debt that this man has incurred because of his madness, it's like a madness no one has ever seen in the history of the world, by the way. On this scale, it's never been seen. Never. Never before has a bunch of incompetent lunatics taken over a nation like this and had other people's credit cards to spend, and like adolescents on marijuana, out of control, adolescents who steal credit cards from their parents while the parents are working, going on a spending spree, buying everything under the sun. And the parents come home and they have to pay the bill.
Savage.
Time we have a quarrel, it almost breaks my heart, 'cause I am so afraid that we will have to part. Each night I ask the stars up above, why must I be a teenager in love? One day I feel so happy.
You know, the rock and roll of the 50s is interesting. Not only that I was a boy when it was, you know, my age, I'm not hiding it, I'm nothing to be ashamed of, I'm proud of it, that I survived this long, by the way. Never thought I'd get here, but here I am, and I'm stronger than I was at 30, incidentally, physically and mentally. I wish to God I was as strong as I am now when I was 30. Honest to God, I feel stronger physically and mentally. I'm probably not. That's part of the deception. Who really knows? But thank God I feel good. So I'm listening to the music, and I realize it's 50 years ago, and yet the music's still beautiful. And I ask myself, is 50s rock and roll beautiful because it reminds me of when I was a kid, or is it beautiful because it's beautiful? It's all love songs.
Eddie, my love, I love you so, how I want it for you. You'll never know.
There's none of that crotch rubbing, gutter garbage that you hear today. There's none of that filth that you hear today in rap music. There's none of the violence and the misogyny you hear in music. It was all about the love for a woman. And love, love, love. That's all it was.
Tell me your love is still only mine. Please,
heart and soul.
That's racist. No, actually, most of the performers, or a good portion, were black. And somehow they didn't have to revert to the gutter and to violence and misogyny to make their music sell, did they? No, it's not about race at all. It's about the degeneration of the United States of America as a society and as a culture. There's nowhere you go today that the filth has not penetrated. The sewer pipe of the entertainment industry has penetrated every aspect of our society. The sewer pipe that comes out of Hollywood has polluted virtually every aspect of our life. You know, I was thinking about this the other day. Take a guy like Red Skelton. You may remember him, you may not. Played a clown, did a good job. I loved him as a kid, didn't know much about him. As it turned out, the man painted. He painted schlocky paintings of clowns. What'd he paint, 1,000 clown pictures? What was he trying to do? I thought about it the other day as a grown man. What do you think he was doing? He was trying to paint the clowns out of his own head. You see what I'm saying? In other words, there was a higher part of Red Skelton. In order for him to perform at all, there had to be a brilliant high element within him, something spiritually higher, right? To be a performer like that. Because he didn't use dirty words. He didn't do anything with filthy, dirty language in order to get a laugh out of an audience. He actually used comedy to attract people, unlike the dirtbags on Showtime and HBO today. Every other word is F or MF or F and MF, 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 F, 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 MF. What'd you say? MF, 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 MF. What'd you say? MF. What'd you say? That's HBO's idea of comedy. Every other word, and that's not comedy. It's insanity. But Red Skelton didn't have to do that, so there was a higher element with him. But the clown he had to use inside himself to hit those notes. But he was depressed that he had to be a clown to get the audience to listen. He probably would rather have been the higher element within himself. Does this make sense to you? See, painted clowns all his life, I think, to rid his mind of the clowns. You'd call them, what do they call them today? Everything they have a psychological word for, and they give you a drug to turn you into a Democrat. What would you call it today? Not the ghosts. In my day, they called it the shadow. Huh? No. Not psychological terms. So they say inner demons. Now, everything's an inner demon. In other words, everything that's a human being, oh, he's got an inner demon, take a pill, come back in 3 months, take another one. We'll see if that doesn't put down the psychosis. We'll give you another one. It'll create the psychosis. What inner demon? It's inner selves. I recognized at age 18 through self-analysis for 5 straight years that if you peel away the onion and keep peeling away the onion of your own self, at the middle of it, you're going to find nothing. At the center of it all, there's nothing. So why peel anymore? So you pack the onion back up and you march forward and that's it. What are you looking for inside? There's nothing there. Hello? Keep knocking. Keep a knocking, but you can't come in. Do you have that song for me right now? Keep, because I know I'm going to get slammed now already with it. Know my God is within. Keep looking within and you'll find God within the center of yourself. All right. Yeah, I know. Jimmy Carter thought he met him in his living room because of the strychnine. I mean, that family drank enough strychnine for the guy to become the peacenik he is. You talk about the average person has nothing on the inside. The Jimmy Carter family with the strychnine and the snakes and seeing his lord and master in the living room. I don't know what he was wearing. I don't know, trousers, tweeds.
Went away and left me
a tuxedo.
Time ago.
Who's this?
Now you
keep a knocking,
but you can't come in.
LBJ in the back. Gail Storm was a stripper for LBJ, wasn't she? I don't know who she was. I grew up on like Argosy magazine. Gail Storm was a stripper. Who's Gail Storm? Turn it off. LBJ liked this kind of thing, didn't he? Whenever Lady Bird wasn't around, he went down to booze it up down then. Okay. Rock and roll. I want some rock and roll. Real rock and roll. Give me some real rock and roll right now on the Savage Nation.
Take good care of my baby. Please don't ever make her blue. Just tell her that you love her. Make sure you're thinking of her in everything you say and do. Take good care of my baby.
Mark Masters, who has syndicated me for over 9 years now, and we're going to be, as Harry Truman said, give him you-know-what for the next couple of years. That's our job. Our job is to be watchdogs, not to be lapdogs, Mark, and I want to thank you for giving me total and absolute freedom to do so. That's the point I'm trying to make. I wouldn't have lasted a week with another syndicator. I could never have sat down after a show and been deconstructed where they say, well, you said this, tomorrow don't say that. That's would have been the end of it for me. I've had total freedom. I need total freedom to function. And Mark, I want to thank you again. I'm glad we're going to be working together. And I know the American people, who particularly the millions and millions of people who listen to this show, are going to breathe a sigh of relief that we have this year to look forward to together. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best of the best from the month of July. I can talk about anything. I think I'm going to talk about Teddy in the restaurant right now. So last night, I had a nice day, by the way. I had lunch in the Greasy Chinese restaurant, which I absolutely love because I don't know, it's like part of my life. I go in there strictly to have my lips sticking together and say, why do I eat here every day? I mean, why do I do this once a week? The answer is because it's part of my life, and it hasn't killed me yet, and I enjoy it. All right, so then at the end of the day, it's like a horse going to a stable, or a cow, rather, goes to a stable at the end of the day on the farm. You know that my father told me, you know, my father was a... Did you know my father rode a wagon in this country with a horse on it? He went back so far in time, he told me when he was 13 years old, he actually had a wagon with a horse on it. That's where the word teamster comes from. They actually teamster horses, teams. So anyway, he was a little kid. He had a laundry route with a wagon at 13. And the horse jumped, I don't know, in cobblestone streets. I don't know, it fell off the thing and a spike went through his foot. So now I'll bring you up to today. So like he told me, like, cows, at the end of a day, they get tired from the pasture. It's boring. There's no TV in the pasture. There's no cell phones. There's no iPhones, nothing. All day long in the hot sun, grinding up grass. They can't wait for the end of the day to go to the barn. So he says, at the end of the day, they all go to the barn. So at the end of the day yesterday, I went up to North Beach to a certain restaurant I go to, the North Beach restaurant. What did I go there for? I went there for the food and to talk with my friend. I told you that. A couple of my friends will always come over when I give them a call. So I'm sitting outside of the restaurant. I had Teddy with me in the city yesterday. Normally, I don't take him to the city when I go to the... I don't like a small dog in the city. He had just had a bath the night before. This dog cannot pass a bush, a tree, a stump, a post, a garbage can without not only just peeing on it, but rubbing against it. He has like a... Something's wrong with him. So Teddy's listening. So I want to take him to a therapist. The rubbing part. I don't mind the marking that males do, but he rubs. He rubs, rubs, rubs. So right away, within 10 minutes, the bath was ruined. And he starts to smell like, you know, a dog. It was horrible. So we get to the restaurant hours later. I'm sitting outside and talking to my friend who owns the restaurant. We talk about everything. It was one of those gorgeous days in San Francisco that you can almost reach out and want a hug. It wasn't hot. It wasn't cold. It was sunny, but the sun was already falling behind the buildings in a cool and nice breeze off the bay. And I'm sitting outside and I'm having, I don't know, a club soda. Yeah, club soda. I didn't want to drink. And Teddy has a bowl of water, and we're talking about everything. Wives and children and the future and illness and mortality and no mortality. And you name it, and laughing the way guys will do when they know each other a long enough time. And just passing the time. So I call up another friend. He comes zipping down on a motor scooter. He sits down. He orders a Spumoni. Because Lorenzo said, I have many centenarians who eat in this restaurant. I said, what? He said, yes, I have a very high number of people over 100 who eat in my restaurant. So naturally, the question becomes, what do they eat? From a guy like me, some of my happiest moments are chatting with other guys over a cafe table and having a meal, watching people coming in for the night, observing people, sitting alone by myself. I enjoy that. So I'm up in front of the restaurant last night, and I'm chatting away, this and that, about it. So my other friend comes over, this and that. And the dog is there and whatever. We're just having a nice, whatever, all about life. Just the way guys will talk when they really trust each other and know each other. So then I go in for dinner. It's now around, I don't know, early in the evening. The place is packed. I sit down and I have Teddy with me. So I put Teddy between me and the wall. He sits quietly on the side. He doesn't bark. He's quieter than most people. And I say, can you get him a hamburger? Just give me a hamburger, no salt and pepper. He says, we don't serve meatballs, we don't serve hamburgers here. I said, okay, Lorenzo, I know, I forgot. So what can you give him? I said, give him some. He said, how about chicken? I said, fine, chicken, no salt and pepper. So he comes out with a plate of salami. He says, for Teddy. I said, Lorenzo, he can't eat salami. He says, no, it's a gooder for him. I said, don't tell me it's good for him, I'm not him. You're feeding him now like you feed me? You make me eat stuff I don't want to eat? I'm not giving him salami. I said, here, I'll eat the salami. Give me the salami, I'll eat a piece. So I did. I said, now give him a piece of chicken. I start with a calamari vinaigrette appetizer. So the dog is now, and the dog gets the chicken. Next, I order veal piccata. I didn't want any more fish. I'm reacting to fish lately. That's enough with the shrimp. No, since the Gulf of Mexico, I don't even eat shrimp anymore because it's all coming from, like, you know, it's like sewer shrimp out of Bangladesh or Thailand. Could you imagine eating shrimp grown in Thailand or Bangladesh? Have you been there? Do you know how they grow the shrimp? Forget, I don't want to eat that. Okay, when I could get it from California, the calamari, I would eat it. I don't even know where that comes from anymore. Most of it's from whatever. So I get the veal piccata, no butter. I want potatoes, no butter, and I had some vegetable, no butter, blah, 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 no butter. And I can't drink wine anymore. I haven't had wine for years. I get sick every time I drink wine. I know it's like so déclassé. I lived on wine, so I passed the litmus test, the Mr. Sophistication, years ago. I can't drink it anymore. For like the last 2 years, I cannot drink wine. In the winter, I can drink red wine when it's very cold. Other than that, I drink beer. That's all there is to it. So here I am in this great restaurant drinking Budweiser with a great meal. I know the people are, oh, yeah, you know, the $200 bottle, $100 bottle, this bottle, that. Let them enjoy it. Good luck to them. Doesn't matter to me. I'm eating, and all of a sudden, a guy comes up from behind me, and he says, excuse me, sir. He says, are you sure that chain is long enough for your dog? I said, what? So, what do you mean? I said, sure, he's fine. I thought the dog was to my right. I turn around. The dog had jumped up on a chair behind me, at the table behind me that was empty, a two-top, and he's sitting in the chair looking at us over the chair. And I realized what he had done. He wanted more food, and he figured he's a person too. In his mind, he's like us. So he figures if he sits in a chair, someone will serve him. You know, dogs are not stupid when you think about it. He didn't get any more food, by the way, because they'll eat until they die. Dogs, you know, will eat until they drop dead. They're not that smart. You could give a dog food, 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 and they will die. They will not stop eating. I've never seen a dog stop eating. You have to figure out what the dog is eating. Anyway, this is neither here nor there. I'm just telling you yesterday, that's all. Then I went home and went to sleep like everyone else and woke up with a hangover even after two beers.
Savage.
Let's talk about dogs. New York, Jim, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Mike, I just want to tell you, probably what Teddy is doing is he's masking his scent. I have a dog, a Chihuahua Pomeranian.
Wait, you mean when he pees on a garbage can or a fire hydrant or a shrub and then he rubs against it, he's doing what?
Yeah, well, what dogs do, this is what the vet told me, because I just went through this last week with my dog. A lot of dogs are marking their spots all over, and what these dogs do is they're picking that up because their sense of smell is so great. And what they instinctively do is they try to, you know, rub themselves onto it and mask their scent so they just don't stick out predominantly.
So in other words, the dog comes home smelling like a fire hydrant.
Yeah.
Because he wants to mask his own scent, or he wants to mask their scent?
He wants to mask his scent so he could sneak up on prey. It's primarily...
Okay. So like if a dog finds a dead a fish in the street, Or any kind of food item, he'd roll on it like that way so that the fish doesn't know that he rolled on it? I don't get it.
Like another dog?
Well, I can tell you, now I know why we're the master and they're the dog. That's all I can say. This logic doesn't work for me. It doesn't work. I mean, now I know why I hold the leash. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm glad he ain't holding the leash. I don't rub against things like that. I mean, would you? That's why they're called dogs. That's all. They're wonderful companions, but I got to tell you the truth. I had to wash the dog when I got home. I couldn't have him in the house. I had to get into underwear. I had to get in the bathtub with him. I had to turn the water on. I had to get the dog shampoo. I had to wet myself. I had to wet him. I had to wash him. All right. I love the little animal, so I didn't mind. I did for him what I never did for my own children. I'll admit it to you. You know, I never changed a diaper in my life. I don't know whether I'm sorry to admit it or I'm not saying I'm proud of it. It's the way I am. It's the way I was raised. My father never changed a diaper. I never changed a diaper. I walked out of the room. There was nothing more disgusting to me than a child's a diaper. I couldn't stand it. To this day, I gag if I'm around the child with a dirty diaper. I gag. And it's why you say to me, why are you... I will not eat in a restaurant with a coloring book. I don't care if it's $100 a glass of wine. The minute I see a coloring book, I leave the restaurant. I know I don't belong there. I know a lot of older parents now think it's cool to bring a child to a restaurant. They give them a coloring book. Some bring globes. I'm surprised they don't bring a tutor and a blackboard. You know, with a video, a whole video set up and do a whole lesson and you got to listen to. The worst people in the world are the 50-year-old guys who finally met a girl through youjerk.com or whatever. And they find the girl that way, another egghead. They meet each other and they have one sickly little child who isn't fed properly. that they raise on vegetarian food, and the child's dying for B6, carnitine, and iron. They raise their boys so that the boy probably could lactate at age 11 by most of these diets. They're so feminized. But they go in a restaurant and they start giving lectures to the child, and you're nearby, you want to bang your head on a glass. They give them lectures, the child don't even know what they're talking about, and they want you to hear how smart they are, either through their child. I don't know what it is. I don't go near it. So you say, well, wait a minute, Mike. You're a big mouth. You have a talk show. The answer, I thought about that. I said, well, what grates me about a guy who speaks loudly in a restaurant to start with? Because I don't. I hate people who yell in restaurants to begin with. I don't mind a conversation, a nice, healthy din, but a loud conversation, terrible. So I said, well, why does that bother you? What, are you an egomaniac? Only you want to talk? I realized why. Because I'm on the radio. You're choosing to listen to me. You could turn this off. You could turn the volume down. In a restaurant, you're a captive audience. And these people know it. You've already put the money into the seat. You're already invested already. You're a captive audience. And those people who do it to you are abusing you in that regard. I don't know how to control. You can't control people. You cannot control people. They're going to do what they want to do anyway. But that's neither here nor there. We're just talking about etiquette and cultural mores. That's all. That's the whole story. I have the greatest callers in the world. It's astounding to me who calls this show. Ordinary people with extraordinary minds. The very people who built this country still exist. The very people who saved this country still exist. Only they're never heard from except on very rare occasions. Sarasota Mary, welcome to the show. You're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. I was calling. I was very concerned about your dream. And
Let me ask you this before we go on. Are you at all an expert in dream analysis?
Well, I've had quite a lot of experience with dreams from God, myself.
All right, well, go on. Okay, then let's just take it as that. Go ahead, please. I met you in the street, told you I had a dream of two black wolves circling me. What does it mean?
I would be very concerned for you, especially with what you're going through. The dream, I do believe, was from the Holy One of Israel himself, warning you and wants to protect you. Those two wolves are two very evil people who are encircling you and wish to devour you. You are their prey, and they want to get rid of you. I don't mean literally physically, but they want you. They want to get rid of you. They are.
Well, the two wolves are the United States government and the British government. Would that work?
That would work, and you can already see it forming. You know, you can see. You know what you were talking about earlier. That you know, those are two gigantic enemies that you've got that you're fighting against. And these people...
Well, what is the classic way to chase away a wolf?
Well, this is what you do. This, when the Lord gives you a dream like that, this is from God Almighty, you go to His Word. You pray to Him for His protection. This is what always I do. You go to Him, to His Word. You go and you pray Psalm 91, Michael, from the Old Testament. That is the greatest psalm of protection. The Israeli army prays that. The Israelites prayed that.
How does it go? Do you have it handy with you? I don't know that one.
It is the one that says, the angel of the Lord encamps about those who fear Him. It is the one that that just talks about the angels encircling about you. It just gives you total protection from enemies. He hides you under the shadow of His wings. It's just such an amazing, powerful. You will feel His power.
That's very beautiful. I can hear it in your voice that you're a very spiritual woman.
I am. I love the Lord with all my heart and soul. He has protected me from such amazing things. I just can't tell you. And He warns me in dreams. And I see it. I see things happen, and I think, oh, my God.
I had thought, to get very pragmatic, that with the incoming administration in England, I didn't expect much of a change, but I thought that a thing so repugnant as this in a nation of free people would be immediately overturned.
I know. It's outrageous. And, again, all I can say, I just never call in radio shows, but I listen to you, and I just went crazy when I heard this dream. I said, oh, my God, he's got to know this. He's got to know this.
Let me say this. Look, Mary, stay on the line. I'm going to send you a copy of the last remaining copies of Banned in Britain. I only have a number of them in inventory. They're only available on michaelsavage.com, and I want you to have one of the rare copies because I'm not reprinting this book. Well, I want to put it behind me, but apparently, you know, just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back back in again. To use a bad joke, but whatever topic is on your mind will be fair game. Let's play the music that is dedicated to the memory of Mel Gibson and Oksana when they first met. Let's begin with this song.
Earth angel, will you be mine?
All right, so he's in love. 90 days, it lasts 90 days, according to Professor Savage. The passion, the love, the girl is the earth angel. The world is going to open up for you like Moses in the Red Sea. You found nirvana. You're going to have one happy day after another. It's been studied worldwide since Roman times, and it's been found to last between 89 and 92 days. Then on the 93rd day, here's what you hear in clip 7. 93rd
Mel,
day.
You are losing your mind. You need medication.
You need a f- take up the f- gold digging f- with a f- gun. And I want my child, and no one will believe you. So f- you.
All right. Then on day 120, we get clip 8. Here's what happens to Earth Angel on clip 8.
And I'm not giving you my house, and you can rot unless you crawl back, suck f- and say you're sorry in that order. Do you understand me? You f- offend my f- maleness, my masculinity, my being, my soul. And you call me a sinner. You're a f- moving violation, showing off your fake f- like they're some special deal.
Are you
How
crazy?
How much do they cost, those fakers?
Are you crazy?
You complain about mastitis. They're fake, baby. Come on, you got little bladders in there. You think I'm an idiot?
It's sad, but that's what happens after about 4 months. So we go from Earth Angel to the following song in every relationship. Now we come to the next stage, which is the Rammstein inside the male. This is what the male, this is what the male feels after 140 days of Earth Angel.
No, du hast mich. Du hast. Du hast mich. Du hast. Du hast mich.
All right, after approximately 160 days, Earth Angel is heard in clip 9.
Have you said everything?
I said nothing! You need to say a lot to assuage my insanity because you made me this.
I didn't make you this way.
You did so.
You were born this way. And you yell and scream and threaten everybody around you. Everybody's fitting around you because they'll scare the out of you. But you ping.
A bunch of using like you. You're like every other.
And then, of course, sadly, in every relationship, it doesn't matter whether it's in Serbia or in Hollywood, after approximately 180 days, the only music that will work will be Pantera with Broken. Let's hear Pantera, and you'll know where we're coming from here on the Savage Nation.
I wonder if we'll smile in a carpet's white
numbers
for days.
So in other words, half the audience already turned the show off. They don't know what I'm talking about. They have no idea what I was doing. It's actually very good radio that I just did. For those who understand, about 1% of the audience got it.
I wonder if we'll smile in a carpet's white numbers for days.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show,
the Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Boy, do I have a special treat for you. It's the best of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Here is the best of the best from the month of July.
People, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving.
I was reading about Bob Dylan for a minute. That's why I started with Bob Dylan. I was on one of the websites and it said, I don't know, something about Jimmy Carter once liked Bob Dylan's music. Then Bob Dylan was so fed up with himself because of the drugs and the womanizing that he converted from Judaism to Christianity. And then once he became a Christian, he stopped using drugs and having fun. And then Jimmy Carter didn't like him anymore. Which makes no sense, because Jimmy Carter is like a fanatic religious guy, isn't he? With snakes and everything. Doesn't he like wave snakes and drink strychnine, which explains his politics? He like baked away his neurons. Took the side of Chavez, takes the side of Ahmadinejad. Hates Israel, hates the Jews. It must be from the strychnine that he drank. But the going back, in other words, what I'm saying is that how could that be true? Why would Jimmy Carter, who's a fanatic religious guy, not like Bob Dylan after he converted to Christianity? And the article wasn't completely true, because about 15 years ago, Dylan went back to being a Jew and he became, like, you know, more religious. I don't know, that's because maybe he wanted to use drugs again and womanize. I don't understand that part of it. He used drugs and he womanized while he was Jewish. And then he got fed up with it, so he became a Christian. He didn't use drugs and womanize while a Christian. But then what, he wanted to use drugs and womanize again, so he went back to Judaism? Isn't that kind of an insult to his religion? I don't, can't follow that conversion. It says, like, you're allowed to do that? I must have missed that in the Old Testament. Where did it say that you can use drugs and womanize in the Old Testament? But it doesn't say that in the New Testament. The whole thing doesn't make sense. But it led me to a question for my audience today, since it's summer and you're not interested in anything, which is this. Have any of you left your religion, whatever it may have been, and gone to another religion? Hold it now. Hold it. And then gone back to your original religion, and why? It's a more of an essay question than a short answer. The short answer question would be, have any of you left your religion and gone to another one? The answer is yes or no. Yes, fine, not interesting. The essay question is, have any of you left your religion of your parents and of your birth, gone to another religion, and then gone back to your original religion, and why? Now you got an essay question, and you can call 1-800-449-8255, because I have a migraine and that's what I'd rather talk about. But let's take the callers as they're lined up. Chicago, Tom, go ahead, please. Religion. You were born a what?
Yeah, I was a Christian, then I became a Buddhist, and now I'm back to my Christian roots.
How long were you a Buddhist?
I was a Buddhist for about 4 years, and I realized I was doing it for the wrong reasons, and I used to watch libs going to Thai restaurants, and it drove me nuts the way they acted. I said, I'm not going to be a part of this anymore, and I felt more comfortable going back to my Christian roots.
Well, you mean you suggested all liberals who go in Chinese restaurants are Buddhists?
No. I've heard you talk about how when libs go into...
Oh, yeah, they bow, or they put their hands together and give a little curtsy when they want a napkin or a glass of water. The guy looks at them like they're nuts.
Exactly, and when I did it, and I'm a conservative, but when I did it, I realized after a few years I was doing it for the wrong reasons.
Wait, I'm mixed up. You're saying you became a Buddhist to get better Chinese food?
No, I became a Buddhist because I was reading books on it, and I was attracted to it, but at the same time...
The fact is that I'll tell you the truth, I never became a Buddhist, but I've read Buddhist literature, the sutras, it's beautiful poetry. And, you know, it's universalist, and many of their writings are universalist. You'll see it transcend any religion. It's commonsensical.
Yes, but then I realized...
Right, but you don't have to be... Here's my point. You can read another religion's writings, but you don't have to become a practitioner of that religion in order to adhere to those teachings, because it will only lead you back to your own religion if you read your own religion more carefully.
Yes, yes, I agree, but it took me a few years to figure that out. But
what made you originally become a Buddhist?
I think maybe I was in a rebellious stage where I was...
It was the women. Come on. Most of them had no bras, and it was the patchouli oil. I know, but you don't even want to admit it.
It was the tie-dyes.
It was the whole thing. You thought you'd get lucky, but it didn't work. All right. So there it is. I remember I was at a hotel in Kauai 15 years ago, and the children were young. I stayed in a room, and they had the books. They used to have in every hotel room a Gideon Bible in America, right? Today, even in the hotel chains that are owned by Christians, there's no Gideon Bible. It's pay-per-view pornography to show you the degenerate nation we live in. Okay, the pornographers have so penetrated our society that every hotel room, instead of having a Gideon Bible for those horrible moments in the middle of the night, they have pornography available in little liquor bottles. Any wonder the country's elected Obama? The people are so stoned and dissipated from porno and alcohol that you have these utter clowns and incompetence ruining America.
And admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone.
We don't know how far this Obama will take this country and how much he can get away with, but I believe he's being run by the most intelligent people in the world. If they could take a shill like he, who had no experience to speak of, who came from an unknown background, who was supported with monies that we don't know where most of the money came from, and pulled us off without much media interest, virtually anything is possible. I have long feared that we'd wake up one day and that we'd see communist Chinese in the White House with the president at the time saying, we have nothing to worry about. We're just changing the structure of our government slightly. Nothing will change. Do not worry. In fact, it's good for the economy. We're going to have a few individuals from the People's Republic of China and from Russia helping us guide this country back to its healthy state. There will be a few changes and nothing more than a few changes. Nothing to worry about. In fact, our debt is going to be absorbed by our friends in China. And we're going to be helped by our friends in Russia with great transfers of oil. And the amount of money we're going to save by eliminating the U.S. Navy, reducing it only to a signal fleet rather than a war fleet, is going to help balance the budget. And right now, I'd like to introduce to you Mr. X from Russia and Mrs. Y from China, who will now be part of our new troika in the White House. There will be a few changes in America, ladies and gentlemen. Some of the most hateful individuals in the media will no longer be heard. In fact, they're going to be re-educated so that they're no longer hurting world affairs in that they've helped slow the reset of our relations with these two friendly giants. And so, therefore, for the health and safety of America, we are no longer permitting any broadcast media except ABC, NBC, and CBS. All cable channels will now be running weight loss shows 24/7. And the individuals behind Fox News will now be going to the re-education camp, along with the talk show hosts who have done so much damage to this nation. The reliable sources of news will be Pravda, ABC, CBS, NBC, and the state-run television out of China, because these are reliable sources. In addition to these changes, there will be some changes in our educational system. References to the wars will be rewritten. We will understand the great sacrifices that were made both by China and Russia in World War II, without whose effort we would have seen a fascist dictatorship take over the world. In addition to this, there'll be some changes in our schools, et cetera. You can fill in the blank. I can write a whole book on it, and I've done. I don't want to give the whole book away because it's not available until it comes out in October 12th, I believe. But this is serious stuff. I don't know how much longer we can take this erosion of our fundamental freedoms, which anybody with a brain, anyone with any historical knowledge, can see Obama is conducting. He is eroding our very freedoms. He is functioning as though he is a dictator. He is saying go to hell if someone tries to challenge him. He believes he has absolute authority. He has no respect whatsoever for the U.S. Constitution or for the checks and balances that were instituted by men 1,000 times greater than he. I'll be right back.
Savage. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from Santa Savage. Here is the best from May of 2010 from the Savage Nation. Anyway, so to go back to the religion thing, I asked the question, you know, if you were one religion and then went into another and then went back to your original religion, why? It's an interesting, it's a transition a lot of people go through. Does it matter? I mean, you know, is it an interesting question to you? I would think it is. If you listen to another person talk about it, like you were born Jewish and you became this, then you went back to Judaism. Or you're born Christian, you became this, then you went back to that. Why? Why'd you do that? North Carolina James, what was your religious passage about?
When I was 14, I read The Naked Ape by Desmond Morris, and I became an atheist. And then
you became an apeist or an atheist?
An atheist.
Because I read The Naked Ape, and I didn't become an ape.
No, I became an atheist.
Why? Because it was a very interesting book, and I did read it. I was a little older, but you're saying it's because he convinced you that we were nothing but the origin of species and the descent of man, and there was no God.
Yes.
Okay, then what happened?
A few years later, I converted to Judaism at the age of 22.
Wait a minute. You go from Christianity to atheism to Judaism. Why?
Things convinced me. I believe that I must have a soul, because I thought to myself, if I didn't have a soul, if a copy were made of my body, why wouldn't that be me?
Okay, that was an interesting concept. That's a cloning question and a very, very interesting one. And how long were you Jewish before I understand you went back to Christianity?
About 2 years.
How did that concept help you get through life?
I feel that I can communicate with God since I became a Christian. I feel that the only way that you can really communicate with God is believing in Jesus.
Now, what about those billions who are not Christians? Can they communicate with God through their own religion?
I believe that since God paid an infinite price for mankind, I believe that you cannot communicate with God except in the sense that you can ask him to save you through faith in Jesus.
So how does that differ from the fundamentalist Muslims who believe that only through Allah you can reach God?
Well, as you know, as Muslims become more religious, they tend to become more violent and follow jihad. As Christians become more religious, they tend to become more peaceful and more loving. And in my opinion, there's only one true religion, and that's Christianity. That's the only way.
I'm not here to argue with you in any way. However, I still believe that with all of the billions of people on Earth, there are many paths to God. I cannot believe for a moment that God would want only a single path.
If you look at
I've been attacked on this subject before by fundamentalist Christians who called me every name under the sun, and I'm willing to accept that they're intolerant of my viewpoint, but the fact of the matter is I believe that by saying only your way is the pure way, you're saying all the other people are less than human. You're saying they're four-fifths a human, and I can't accept that. But hey, I respect your way. I also respect people who are atheists. I think they're wrong. I think they're gambling, and they're going to be found out to be wrong at the end of the road. I certainly can't prove it. If I could, I would. But again, I've been attacked for this. I guess I didn't expect it to happen again today, but it was inevitable that it would if I bring up religion. I may as well give you my religious perspective for whatever it's worth. It's one man's opinion. I want you to take a pencil in your head, and I want you to draw a circle. Can you do that? Draw that circle in your head? I'm very good at pictographic verbiage. You drew a circle in your mind. Now draw a little circle in the middle of that circle. Now imagine that that little circle is the tunnel to God. Now take lines from the big circle and draw them to the little circle. Okay? And those lines can represent any one of the principal religions on earth, whether it be Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, or Hinduism. I'm using the five principal religions on earth because they represent the majority of people. I recognize there is Zoroastrianism and other religions, but I would like to focus for the moment only on the five principal religions of the earth. And I would say that each of these religions are conduits to that tunnel to God, and that if people truly believe in their religion and they practice their religion and it brings them closer to God, meaning they can behave more godly and nicer to their fellow man, so be it. But the minute one religion starts to say, only my religion can get people to God, all the other religions are less perfect than mine, therefore all the other people are less perfect than I, therefore we are creating conflict, and therefore the religion fails. Any religion that says the other religions are less than them, or it is a lesser religion, is creating conflict, which is in opposition to the teachings of the religion itself. I want you to understand what I just said to you. It's actually quite a brilliant concept if you analyze it, which is that if you say that your religion is so exclusive that only those in your religion can see God or reach God, what you're doing is creating conflict between yourself and the rest of humanity. And in so doing, you're violating the tenets of your own religion or the teachings of your own religion. Because after all, analyze any religion. I don't care what the religion is. I can boil any religion on earth down to one phrase, and I've done this before. Since it's summer, I'll do it again. Which is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Think about it. Think about it. It says it all. I mean, there are ways to arrive at that concept of kindness. But at the end of the day, most religions teach the same thing. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Seven.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Here is the best of the best from the month of July. You could practice every tenet of your religion and be the worst SOB on the planet. And what does that make you? What does that make you? You're a religious man, but you push aside a woman who's 9 months pregnant on an airplane to get a seat? What does that make you? A holy man? It makes you a pig. And I've seen it happen. I mean, and so forth and so on. Or you believe in your religion and you're willing to cut someone's head off to prove how holy you are. Well, this is all fraudulent. If you're that much of a zealot and you're excluding every other religious practice as less than yours, you're going to create war. And so therefore, since I am a man of peace and I think that all people should see God, I believe that all religions, in my mind, are equally valid for those who believe in them, so long as it leads to the same conclusion, which is that do unto others as you would have them do unto you, or you want to reverse it, do not do unto others as you would have them not do unto you, whichever way you want to look at it. So that's it. That's what I mean by, that's my view, rather, of the whole thing, you know. Now, again, it's one man's opinion. I know many of you are going to be angry at me, and you're going to start. I get emails for years after a thing like this. And I appreciate that you're angry at me, if you are. How about if you're not angry at me and you agree with me and you're a Christian? Because I've had Christian theologians call me and write me and say, you're right. Those who don't see, and they're devout Christians, and they see it my way. So don't assume that your view of Christianity is the only way either. You may have been mistaught, by the way, to think that only your way is the right way. Just as I say to you, I'm an individual with one viewpoint. And the day religion starts to create strife is the day religion is not doing its job, so to speak. What is the meaning of religion? Tell me what the meaning of religion is. Is it not to give man peace and show him a way? What is the meaning of a religion to begin with? Let's start from the beginning. Let's clear the slate. Get out your mental eraser. Child is born. A child has nothing. A child has no religion. A child may have a soul, or it may not have a soul. I believe there are children who are born without souls. I believe there are children who are born evil. And, of course, they become Democrats. But putting aside the humor for the moment, there are children who have souls, and the soul does not know what it is. It could be raised in any church. It could be raised in a synagogue. It could be raised in a Buddhist temple. It could be raised in a Hindu temple. It could be raised as an atheist. It could be raised as a socialist. It could be raised as a communist. And, of course, the communists want to grab your child before that child has been developed, and they want to brainwash that child because they understand that hearts and minds are important to grab, and that's why they have brainwashed your children through the NEA and through the public schools into believing that only a large government, only a big government, only government can help them and government is good. And so therefore, again, the religious will become the political at a certain point, which is why the communists said that religion is the opiate of the masses, because they recognized that people who truly believed in God were unlikely to convert to statism. They would not worship the Obama of their time. They would not worship Barbara Boxer of the Barbara Boxer Politburo types of their time, because they would not bow down to false idols. And Obama's a false idol, make no mistake about it. The man has held himself up as an idol to be worshipped, not a president to lead a nation. The man has narcissism to the nth degree. The man has many psychological problems that are not being discussed because the people in the media are too close to the situation to recognize that we have a psychological mess on our hands with this president. And one day it'll be discussed, whether it's 50 years from now or 5 years from now, the books will start to come out. So we've wandered far afield from the religious question. I have been in places where I have felt the walls shake with fervent belief. And it's when you're only when you're with a congregation of true believers, whatever the religion may be, that you can truly feel the thunder of God. I mean, it's very hard to feel it alone. Many of you can. You can be on a ship in the middle of the sea, and in the middle of a storm, you'll see God. And I've felt things like that in my life. I've been on ships where I almost died. I've almost died falling off a cliff. I mean, you can see God in many ways, positive and negative. But I want to stick to the religion for a minute. I remember, for example, being, when I was a kid, I went into a Brother Billy in the streets of New York. And he was a street preacher. And I was interested in meeting, you know, even the craziest people on earth at the time. At the end of that day, I wound up driving him up to Harlem into a storefront Abyssinian church, and those walls were shaking. The people were talking to God. I felt God in that room. I have been later on in my life in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York on a Christmas Eve. There was God. I felt God in that cathedral. I have been at 777 Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn with the Hasidim, the Orthodox Jewish people, when there were thousands of men in black garb, packed shoulder to shoulder, meeting God on the Sabbath. I have felt God in that room. I have been in a straw hut in the Fiji Islands drinking kava kava with the Fijian people as they were chanting. I don't know who was in that room, but I certainly wasn't in the room alone with only those seven men. So there are many places on earth where the people can find unity and find God. And I have been lucky enough to have it a few times. At this time in my life, perhaps I'm too isolated, alone, and too much of a recluse. I'm not comfortable in any group setting in religion. I don't know what it is, but I just don't know why I've walked away from the whole package. I have on my desk my Bible, the Old Testament, with dozens, if not hundreds, of yellow tabs in it. You know, post-its. I told you about this Bible many times. It's been photographed and put on my website, michaelsavage.com. It's not there now. Because I want you to understand I'm not just making this stuff up. When things go real bad, we all tend to reach for something other than, you know, a glass of whiskey or a cigarette. And I think most people will admit that at certain points, you have to believe in something. As my mother taught me, everyone has to believe in something. And many will say, well, I don't believe in God. And I've told you before that if you're an atheist who believes in nothing, then you believe in something, and that something is nothing. I know it sounds like a joke, but you do believe in something if you believe in nothing. You know, so try to hit this empty. Try to make this world, try to go through this world empty. I don't think you're going to get too far. And I think that's why so many people do fall into the hole of drugs or the hole of drugs or alcoholism. Well, whatever it is. And we all struggle with this. We're all struggling. None of us have a halo. And there's nothing to rejoice in some ways. And there's everything to rejoice in some ways. So, I mean, I'm going around in circles because it's summertime, and I have that feeling of a kid at the end of June rather than July, where the school year is still on, but there's only a few more days, and he can't look at one more book. He has to close the books. He can't. He opens a book, and it's so hot outside, and he sees the flies buzzing right outside the screen of the schoolyard, and he hears the birds outside the window, and he doesn't want to be in that room anymore. He wants to be outside, and he wants to be free, and he wants to walk in the clean sunlight of the day, but he's stuck inside that room, and that's where I am today. In that day a man shall cast away his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship, to the moles and to the bats. And the idols shall utterly pass away, and men shall go into the caves of the rocks, and into the holes of the earth, from before the terror of the Lord, and from the glory of his majesty, when he has ariseth to shake mightily the earth. Isaiah. What does it mean? Whatever you want it to mean. Or nothing, depending upon your viewpoint. New York City, W.O.R. John, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, sir. My personal belief is however the universe works and whatever it has in store for us is just that. And irrespective of what belief system we believe in, whatever is going on in this world is going to happen to us, and we can believe in Judaism, Christianity.
So you think you're just a leaf in a stream going downstream and there's nothing you can do as a leaf?
I'm sorry?
You believe that you are like a leaf thrown into a stream, and you're just moving along in that stream, and that you have no effect upon the stream itself.
I believe that I have an effect on this world if I choose to, but
you're saying, wait, you're saying you have no free identity and free association? You can't make your life become what it should be? You can't alter situations and affect the outcome of your life?
I certainly can, but not after death. As I said, however the universe works. And
yeah, but wait. I want to back up on this, because many people think that they're just leaves in a stream and they have no effect upon their destiny. You don't believe that, though.
No, I do believe that in my destiny, as far as if I decide to be a bum who's drinking on the corner or a PhD like yourself. But once we die, it's up to the universe. And just because you believe in Christianity doesn't necessarily...
Wait, what do you mean by it's up to the universe? What is up to the universe once we die?
That I don't know. And I don't believe that anybody knows. And just because we subscribe to a particular theory...
I understand. But do you believe that your acts while you are living will have any effect upon what happens afterwards?
I don't know. But I will tell you that I definitely try to do the right thing in life, just in case. That's
sure. All right. Well, there's many reasons to do the right thing. Some of them are based upon selfish motives, such as just in case, and I have ascribed to that as well. I want to gamble that there is a judgment day. And so, you know, not necessarily because I'm such a good person.
Savage.
Religious proselytizers, nymphomaniacs, liberals. And here we are in the Savage Nation, many years later, and we're talking about religion. And I don't know how I stumbled onto this, but I raised the question that a question arose from me to the audience, where I said, were you once born into a religion, then you went to another religion, and then went back to your original religion, and why? The essay question, not the short answer. And I remember how this question arose once. I was once sitting in Berkeley, as a matter of fact, in the 70s, it was on a Sabbath. There was to be a discussion before a dinner. The dinners were incredible. In fact, the food was as much a part of the religion as any. You got to remember that food is a big part of any religion. If it's a good religion, food is a big part of it. It's what gets the people in and keeps them coming back. But the dinners were great. They were communal dinners. Everyone would help cook and eat and drink. Lots of drinking. But before the dinners, there was some conversation. And there was a rabbi who was talking. And he was known as a very, there's all levels of everything. This guy was known as very insightful, let's put it to you that way. And he said something once. He was an interesting guy. I mean, he wasn't like, you know, Zeus sitting up on a mountaintop. He looked a little bit like Woody Allen. As a matter of fact, very soft-spoken. And he said that all religions are good, but the religion you were born into is the religion that you're meant to follow, is what he said to the group. And somehow that stuck with me. He also once, a cat or dog walked in the middle of the discussion into this house of prayer, and everyone went, oh, there's a dog, get it out. And he said, no, it's probably somebody who was Jewish when they were a person. And he's lonely. He wants to come back and see some friendly people. which I thought was very unusual for a religious setting. Anyway, but those days are long gone. It was a spiritually interesting period, the 70s in America, and many, many interesting things occurred, and many interesting people occurred, and things were, in some ways, phenomenally elevated. Don't underestimate all of what happened in the 70s. Don't write it all off as pornography, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Yeah, that rose up in that time, but so did a lot of other great things rise up in that time as well. You know, it all came up. There was so much ferment and so much creativity in America that everything came up, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So here we are now, and I don't know whether to say we are living in a cynical time, a more cynical time. When was it not a cynical time in America? The 50s, you're saying, wasn't a cynical time. Behind the ad men? What was behind the ad men? Behind the button-down guy, behind Mad Men? We talked about it yesterday. What was going on behind the scenes? What's going on today behind the scenes? Same thing. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Now, there is a new element, of course, socially, and that's why we have Obama, who was a faker as president, which is the high degree of drug usage in the population. And the supersaturation of entertainment has melted down the American mind to the point that a fraudster and a huckster like this could actually get away with being a president and push open communism and not be seen for it, except by a few people. Which leads me back to what I said we were going to do before. 1-800-449-8255, New York. No, let's go to Los Angeles, okay? The show is heard all across the country, as you know. Let's start on L.A. Earl, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Michael, I got to tell you, I love you so much, and you are doing such a great job. Brother, I've been with you for at least for the last year listening to you just about it.
Thank you. Well, you know what? It takes one person at a time to make a show. So what was your religious path?
I started off in a very evangelical, charismatic Christianity. I moved on, and this is why the political is important, to a more a fundamentalist Christianity. And politics is all throughout that, and you really have to have a grasp on politics. That'll help you understand what's the difference between liberal, conservative, I mean, the whole nine. Well, for me, my path was going from that till it got to a point where I had to move back from all of it and to examine what you do, Michael. You try to find out what the truth is.
Yeah, good luck. Yeah, but you know, it's like pondering your navel at a certain point. In other words, you can analyze things to death and wind up with no one but yourself and a dog, too.
Absolutely. If you keep it simple, man, I got to tell you, you to me are the very nemesis of Obama, because he is all about subtlety. You are all about just straightforward talk. You don't care who hates. You don't care how people feel about it. Or matter of fact, the more people.
Well, I know. It's, maybe it's foolish, you know, looking back 15 years of speaking my mind without any red lights on the roadway. I mean, it's gotten me in a lot of trouble, too, you know.
Well, absolutely. Well, wait a minute. Here's where you have to, man. I can't encourage you enough. Do you know that one of the main characteristics of Satan, the Bible talks about his subtlety? I mean, Obama. The best reading that you will probably get, I don't know if you've read this before, it's an interview by this lady called Kathleen Falsani, Falsani. But anyway, she interviewed Obama to figure out what he believed. And as a man thinketh, so he is. All you need to do is get into what the guy thinks, his belief system, and that tells you everything. I mean, he is so subtle. You don't know whether he's Christian.
Well, he's a politician in that regard. I've read Aristotle's The Politician, so I understand they're all the same in that regard. They never speak the truth. They speak in syllogisms, and they never tell you anything. They let you believe what you want to believe. But your own path, you started as a regular Christian evangelical. You became what next?
After I became a fundamentalist Christian.
And then what?
The church I was at, the guy was so heavy-handed, he told people who it was like living in a dictatorship. That's what it was like, and that's why
I understand that. That's right. Religions can become very dictatorial and very hierarchical, which turns me off. Did you then become something different, religious-wise?
I almost became heretical if a Christian, a dogmatic Christian, looked at me, and I was a dogmatic Christian. He'd say, hey, man, you're believing all these universal things. I guess I became Gnostic or a New Age belief. But I actually pulled back, and I started using terms like truth and trying to find out or what universal laws were as opposed to...
But what are you today? Are you a practicing Christian today?
What? this is really huge. I can't pull back so far while I lose my whole foundation. So
that's correct. But I'm saying, but you're still a Christian, I hope.
I you know what? I almost lost it, really, until I started observing that.
But that's the problem, Earl. You'll find out if you disconnect your moorings to such an extent that you're floating at sea, you're going to have nothing. And then you're going to be in the sea of darkness. You may never find your way back. Don't cut that last line to that religion. I am syndicated by an independent syndicator who is not in any sense a major corporation. Maybe he will be one day. Maybe he knows them. But you see, Limbaugh and Beck are part of corporate talk. And whether you believe it or not, it doesn't really matter whether the corporate talk is left or right. There is a club. And corporate talk only talks about others within the corporate talk fraternity. That's the beauty of it. The beauty is that they can get away with it because the people themselves don't even see the hypocrisy. And now you understand what corporate broadcasting is as opposed to independent broadcasting. With God's will and your listenership, I shall return.
Savage.